Okay, now it is my privilege tonight to introduce our speaker. I know him for about a year now, because I have about a year myself, and so I saw him come into the rooms, and he was always so quiet. He still is very quiet. The only time I actually get to hear how he's doing is when he gets to share. So I'm very honored to hear his story tonight, just like you guys are. So let's give him a hand. His name is Ray D. He's from Visalia, and he's celebrating a year.
Well, in all fairness, I'm celebrating a year this time. This is the third pass. Hey, but how great was that to see so many people come up and get chips tonight? Isn't that great? Give yourself a hand. That is terrific. I've come the last few weeks and kind of observed this group to see what was going on. And I've had a variety of people that sit at tables with me, some of whom are really into it and part of the crowd, and others of whom don't seem to be particularly interested, as Phil pointed out earlier. And it led me to a question, which is, why are we here? I know why I'm here. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. But I think it's a question we have to ask ourselves every time. Am I here because a judge told me I had to be someplace and this is as good as any and I don't have to actually talk here, which is the good part? Or because it's warmer than it is outside? That's a good reason for coming. Or because it's, I have to admit to myself that I have a disease. And that disease isn't going to go away. And I can pretend like it's going to go away, but it isn't. And so with that thought, and as somebody who admittedly has that disease, I'd like to share a few moments with you tonight about why I think AA works. And maybe more than anybody else, at least that I know, certainly some of you are going to have better stories, but more than anybody else that I know, I am a living testament to the fact that it doesn't work if you don't have an AA. I've been there. Been there several times. I was sober for 15 years. I was a dry drunk. But there was no structure. And I was sober for 5 years, another time. Dry drunk. No structure. This is the first time in my life that I've had a structure. And the structure is right here. And it's you guys. And it's AA. Why does it work? It's simple. It's basic. The rules are simple. There are 12 of them. Nothing hard. It's not like quantum physics or something else or trying to operate my cell phone. Or some of the other things in my life that I can barely operate, but thank God I have teenage daughters. It has instructions I can follow, and it stays the same day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Nothing really changes for us, does it? It's the same rules, same plan, same everything, and that's comforting. It's nice. It reminds me, and this is a Super Bowl week, so I'll use a football analogy here. There was a coach, and most of you are too young to remember this guy, Vince Lombardi.
Oh, yeah.
he was a pretty good coach. Coached the Green Bay Packers years ago and coached in the first Super Bowls. Jerry Kramer, who was one of his star players, linemen, wrote a book about Vince Lombardi once, and they asked Jerry Kramer, why was Vince Lombardi such a great coach? Well, what made him a great coach wasn't just his ability to motivate. It was that he kept it simple. He kept it basic. And he would begin every spring practice the same exact way. He'd walk out on the field and there'd be a whole team of, NFL all-stars and all these high draft choices and all these college superstars and kids who had played football their entire life. He would walk out on the field, he'd take a football, he'd hold it out and he'd say, "Gentlemen, this is a football." And that's where he'd start. Let's start all over. Let's start with the basics. "Gentlemen, this is a football." gentlemen and ladies, we are alcoholics. That simple. That basic. So, we look at these steps, and we say, we've got these 12 steps to sobriety. They're pretty simple. We all know them. They're in the book. We've all got a book. And my other one's pretty dog-eared. This is the one I got last year when I went through rehab. We'll get to that part. But the first three steps are really crucial to me. And I'm just going to read them. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. Interesting. And then we made our decision to turn our will and our lives over to that power. Here's where we get into trouble. Here's where I got into trouble. Because most of us don't like to turn our will over to people. And certainly to some power. Because there's one thing that we share as a group, and I think most of us have it, and that's pretty good egos. And we at least carry it on the outside. And so I know I had one, and I still do, and I'm sure most of you do. So turning that over was really tough for me. So how do you go about that? To me, that's the most interesting part of this story. And to do that, we have to do a little American Sniper thing here. I don't know how many of you have seen American Sniper, but at the beginning of the movie, we have our guy who has a beat. I'm not going to spoil it for you. He has a beat on a target. And then all of a sudden, you do backstory. So at this point, I'm going to cut away to backstory. We'll come back to where we are right now about how do we turn our will over to God and whatever God is to us. So for backstory, who am I and why is this guy standing here talking to you? What do I have to offer? I don't know, probably not much, but I started out in the Midwest. Unlike a lot of you, I'm not from Visalia originally. I'm from the dirtier part of Kansas. And grew up in a farm for the first few years of my life. We're on a farm without running water. We had a pump in the kitchen and a pump outside. Had an outhouse. Had a wind-up phone. Party line. So you could, you know, listen in on each other and do all that. And if you wanted to make a call, you called the operator and she plugged in the number. It was pretty rustic. Air conditioning was a joke. I mean, we didn't know what that was. Air conditioning meant you open the windows. Heat was were coal stoves that you stoked at night, and you sure as hell didn't want to be the first person up in the morning because it was colder than snot in the summer and in the winter, and you'd go to the stove, and the first one there would have to get the coals going, and you just freeze. And then you'd go out and break ice off of water troughs for pigs and cattle and things like that. So as I grew up, my dad was an alcoholic, eventually killed him. My mom was an alcoholic, but less obviously. It eventually put her in prison. And I didn't drink because I fell down the other way. I kind of, as a kid, and I've heard most of you know a lot of your stories and talk about, you know, I drank young, I did all that. I didn't. I kind of went the other way. And we generally, after a while, after a few years, we lost the farm, and my dad started working from job to job and place to place. And we kind of were always one step ahead of the landlord. We'd move whenever the rent was due. So I went to 39 grade schools. I actually sat down once and counted. 17 junior highs. And my sophomore year in high school was my fifth high school. And I said, okay, pardon me, but enough of this shit. I'm gonna take care of myself. So I did. So I moved into a motel, which cost $35 a month. Just a fine place. Run by the Trucker's Motel on Highway 81 in Wichita, Kansas. I still remember it. And across the street was a truck stop where you could get all you could eat breakfast for 35 cents. Do you know how much food a 15-year-old kid can eat in the morning? I mean, it's like, I'll have a dozen eggs and 2 pounds of bacon, please. And that'll be the appetizer. And I got a job, and I was all of 14 years old, living in this motel room. But I was an entrepreneur, and I figured out a way to pay for the motel room, which was, on prom night, I would rent it out by the hour. And that paid for the whole semester. So it worked out really well. I got a car because in Kansas in those days you could drive when you were 13. You had a driver's license. And I worked on a farm, so that was okay. So I got a car. It was a 51 Ford. It was so rusted out that you could watch the road go by underneath. And I still remember taking a girl to a dance once, and she wore high heels, and her shoes went right through the floorboard. It was like, but it was good because I didn't really have any brakes, and she could use her shoes. That I just made that part up. At any rate, that was high school. And out of all of that, while everybody else was getting bombed and everything else, I was working my tail off. And sort of like the apple that fell away from the tree with the alcoholic parents, I didn't drink. But I wanted to go to college because nobody in my family had ever gone to college. So I got a scholarship to go to Wichita State University. And if you're a basketball fan, they're pretty good at that. So went to Wichita State, and that started out fine. I discovered that if I drank beer and smoked cigarettes, I didn't get quite as hungry. And I didn't have a lot of money, and it was more efficient to drink beer and smoke cigarettes than it was to eat. So, and I had my scholarships were in academics and in theater, because I was an actor. That's how I had gotten through high school, as an actor in plays and things like that. So this is where it all begins to tie together. Got to a point where I didn't really notice a drinking problem. I mean, I drank, but, you know, that's what you do in college. You drink, you throw up, you wreck cars, you know, basic college stuff. And so I had the first real event in my life that taught me that there was a higher power. A true miracle happened in my life because I got so broke. I mean, I had scholarships to pay for school, but I couldn't afford to eat, and I'd wrecked my car. And so I stood on a hill in the middle of the campus of Wichita State one day because I had run out of money and I hadn't eaten in a couple days, and it was pretty awful. And I stood on this hill and I looked up to the sky and I said, okay, God, it's in your hands. I took over when I was 14. I've worked my butt off. I've done crazy stuff. I managed to stay in high school even though it was illegal for me to be in high school without parents. Did all that stuff, but I'm out of gas. It's yours. I'm going to turn it over to you. And I don't know what else to do. Because if I can't come up with some answer right away, like money, I've got to drop out of school. So I went into the class that I was scheduled to take, which was a History of Western Civ class, I'll never forget. It's one of those big lecture halls, like, you know, with 500 kids and a bunch of graduate assistants up there. This old professor who had been a survivor of Auschwitz, literally, and this very thick German accent. And I took the test because I'd studied, and I handed it in, and this graduate assistant came over and he said, "Aren't you Ray Dreidman?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, Dr. Reif wants to see you." And I said, "He does?" I didn't even know he knew who I was. He said, "Yeah." So then Dr. Reif came over and he said, "Do you know where my office is?" Well, he was the dean of liberal arts, and I said, "Yeah, I know where it is." He said, "Well, meet me there right after class." So I went over to his class, and he said, "What's this I hear about you dropping out of school?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I hear you're dropping out of school." Well, here's the weird part. I hadn't told anybody I was dropping out of school. The only thing I'd done was stood on that stupid hill and said, "Help." And I said, when did you hear that? And he said, I don't know. I think it was in the faculty lounge last night or something. I thought, how weird is that? He said, well, I was on one of your scholarship committees, and I'm not used to giving scholarships to people so you drop out of school. So come with me. So we went to the financial aid's office, and they had a $3,000 check ready for me and a job on campus, the work-study program, and a National Defense Student Loan. And there it was. And I said, wow. And to this day, and I'm 67 years old, to this day, I can't tell you how that happened. And Martin and I talked about it until he passed away. And we became friends. And he never really knew how he knew. But he knew. And he knew before I asked. There's the scary part. And so, everything's hunky-dory and wonderful, so I go to school, get my bachelor's degree, get accepted into a big graduate program. I'm one of 15 people in the United States who gets accepted into the acting company at the Hillbury Classic Theater at Wayne State University in Detroit. Go to Detroit, big deal, do my acting up there, get the first of my two master's degrees, and then decide to go to New York. Go to New York, and I don't know anybody. Well, I know one actor in New York who I'd been in a play with in Summersock. And he said, oh, you're here. Why did you call me? And I said, because you said to call you if I ever got to New York. And he said, yeah, but I just said that. I didn't really mean it. That's what you say. And I said, oh, okay, well, here I am calling. He said, well, by the way, I've got this actor staying with me, and he's got to go to L.A., and he's got to be in a Twilight Zone episode, and he needs a cover. Can you cover a show? You could play the part. It's a two-character play off Broadway. This is my first day in New York. Well, the actor that was staying with him was an actor named Martin Sheen. And so I went down and auditioned for the director of the show, who was George C. Scott. And 2 days later, went on stage playing opposite George's wife, Colleen Dewhurst, in a show in New York. And shortly thereafter, I got a role in Fiddler on the Roof and did that. And then I did 7 or 8 other Broadway shows and sang and danced and carried on. And so things just fell into place. Well, in the meantime, so did drinking. Because now all of a sudden there was nothing to stop me. I had plenty of money. Bought a house in New Jersey. You know, living the good life. And so a couple of beers became a couple of vodkas, became a couple of martinis. But I didn't have a problem. I mean, I always made it to the theater. Did my shows. Wasn't drunk. I wasn't like you guys. Right? And so I eventually moved to Los Angeles because I wanted to kind of expand my horizons. And frankly, I was getting tired of performing. I wanted to move on the other end. So I opened a theatrical agency, and it was really successful. We represent a lot of big stars. I won't bore you with the details on how that all came about, but it did. Then I started packaging movies, and so I produced some movies and produced some TV shows. Wrote a bunch of TV shows. I think in 1988 I had 52 TV shows on the air that I either wrote or produced or directed or something. Everything from Miami Vice to Hill Street Blues to you name it. Got to be friends with lots of big important people. Wrote Smokey Robinson's Club Act for Vegas. Wrote Sammy Davis, for those of you who are older, wrote his Club Act. Robin Williams and I became really good friends, and Robin and I wrote some things together. It was a great life. Bought a house in Malibu, 2.5 acres. In Malibu, on a mountaintop. Drove a Maserati and a Jaguar. Collected MGs. Just had a great time. Sat at the Super Bowl next to Johnny Carson. You know, did all that. And thought, wow, this is great. I think I'll have a drink to that. Because, I mean, look at what I've done. Hey, because I did this, right? Bull. I didn't do jack. I just used the tools I was given. Somebody else made it all possible. Or something else. And I forgot that part. And so, along about the age of 42, I discovered I kind of developed this drinking problem, which was now augmented with cocaine. Because in the 80s, that was the go-to drug in Hollywood. I used to go to parties, and there'd be a bowl of Coke that was like this, with a bunch of straws. I mean, that was like the centerpiece. Serious, and quite often it was pharmaceutical. It wasn't even cut. I mean, this was the real deal. One of my friends, Gene Landy, was the psychiatrist who had gotten Brian Wilson out of bed when the Beach Boys, when he went catatonic. And Gene was a psychiatrist, so he could prescribe cocaine. So we got the good stuff. But I was lucky through this whole time. I got stopped on the freeway once, bombed out of my mind by cops. I had probably an ounce in my pocket. Was driving the mother, top down, doing 120 miles an hour, and got pulled over and passed the field sobriety test. And the cops took me home. One other time I fell asleep driving to my house in Malibu up the hill, and they stopped and took me home. I mean, it had been better if they'd arrested me, frankly. But they didn't. And so things kept getting worse and worse, and I got more and more drunk. But you know, when you're important enough, you can get away with it. You can go to your meetings at Universal and say, hey, screw it, I'm going to have a drink. Because I had a bar in my office. Because that's what we did in those days. That's what we always did. And so, finally, at the ripe old age of 42, having lived all of this, I said, you know what, I'm going to die if I don't do something. And Robin said a really interesting thing to me one day. He and Richard Belzer, who some of you may remember from the cop show. At any rate, Richard's the craggy-faced actor that's been on it forever. We were working on a project for Universal, and we were over at my house, and Robin's standing on a big rock, and he looks out, and he says, you know what cocaine is? And I said, what is that? And he said, it's God's way of telling you you make too much money. He was right. He was right. So I decided to get sober. So first I got divorced, and then I started to get sober, and the sobriety part was kind of interesting because, you know, I'd done everything myself, because after all, I didn't need anybody. So what I did was I went to a motel and put myself through a week of absolute hell and with my boxer dog, and who would just look at me as I was throwing up. I went through a week of DTs and total detox, and it was the most horrific. I'm telling you, that was hell. And it's as close as I ever want to get. And managed somehow to come through it, but by the end of it was like this. And decided, well, probably the entertainment business at this point in my life was going to kill me. So I'd do something else. So I got remarried and to somebody else and moved to her hometown, which was Lompoc, which it was a little like Kansas in the 50s. It was windy all the time and it just felt like home. So I moved there, and after about 6 months, she said, well, you need to get a job. And I said, why? And she said, because you probably want to stay married. And I said, okay, what'll I do? Because what does an old tired movie producer, TV writer, TV producer do in Lompoc, California? So I saw an ad in the paper that said the Ford store needed a car salesman. So I thought, well, you know, it's just like the movie business. It's balloons and hot air. So I'll go do that. So I went down and I applied, kind of hid the fact that in the meantime, I had also picked up a PhD in theology, which was just kind of because that was my gift back for the college deal. And so I went down and kind of lied about my background and stuff and got hired. And 6 months later, I was the finance director. And 9 months later, I was the sales manager. And a year later, I was the general manager of the store. Because I worked really hard. I always have. And I could make it. And guess what happened? Things were good. We climbed a new mountain, and we didn't even know we had a mountain there. And they're good. Let's celebrate with a drink. But you know, it's this damn disease we have. It won't let us just have that one drink. We want to, and we hear it at every meeting, don't we? We would love to drink like normal people. We can't. Yet can't. If you believe nothing else about AA, believe that. You can't. Been there, done that. A year later, I was out of a job. Again, I bankrolled some money, so guess what we did? We went through a week, checked myself into a rehab down in L.A., dried up. This time, thank God, was in shock, so it wasn't quite as painful. And went back and decided, you know, I'd go back into the car business. I'd be better this time. And this is how I ended up in Visalia. Because the guy I used to regularly beat on the coast in car sales was Don Garpetti. So Don called me. He had just bought the Toyota store here. And he said, hey, Ray, you run Toyota stores. You want to come run this one? And I said, where the hell is Visalia? And he said, it's between Fresno and Bakersfield. You'll love it. It's cool in the summer and warm in the winter. I said, wow, that sounds great. He said, be sure to come over this certain afternoon in October. So I did. I forgot he was a car guy. Yeah. And so he took me to the Vintage Press for lunch, drove me around downtown, said, this is what you got. Went back, called my wife and said, okay, you want to move to Visalia? And she said, not really. And I said, well, okay, I'll just go back to the table and pick a number out of the air that Don's going to have to pay me if I come here. And he won't do that because I know how badly the store did last year. And that'll be that. So I went back to the table and I told Don, I said, you know, I'd have to sell my house. What he doesn't know, of course, is that I can't get a job on the coast at this point because the word's out that I drink. Well, I found out later he did know, but he was willing to take a chance. And I said, I need this much. And he said, can you be here Tuesday? And I went, I guess I can. So that's how I ended up in Visalia. And I told Don at the time I wasn't going to stay with it that much longer. I wanted to do something else with my life, which I'd done for years, which was going to physical therapy. So in the meantime, I opened a gym here, which I still have, which does very well. And this went on for quite a few years, bordering on, well, about 12, actually. I think I said 15. It's actually 12. And then came June, a little before that, of 2013. And guess what? Here it came again. Because my daughter, who was now an actress in L.A., got her a series. So I went down to celebrate with her. Well, she'd never seen me drink. So we went to dinner, and she said, here, have a glass of wine. And I said, I can have a glass of wine. Well, that was actually in February of 2013. And by July of 2013, 24/7. And then a miraculous thing happens, and this is where we now go back to the sniper and the gun. That's the backstory. The miraculous thing that happened was I was drinking in the gym. That hardly captures it. I had glasses, I thought, hidden everywhere in the place so I could grab a drink here and there. And seven or eight of my clients, a couple of whom are here tonight, bless their hearts, walked in the gym one Monday morning and said, "Can we see you?" And I said, "Sure." And they took me in one of the rooms and said, "You know, you helped us when we had physical problems. You have a problem. So we're going to take you away. We've got your gym covered. We've got everything handled. We've already paid for it, so you can't say no. So you're going to rehab, but this time you're going to stay." And so they packed a couple of bags and threw me in a car and drove me 8 zillion miles north to this place, Changing Echoes, that was somewhere north of San Andreas, up in the mountains. And my favorite part of this place was I showed up and you walked in, and there were 18 people and 15 counselors. It was great. And they said, "Well, we have an open door policy." I said, "Yeah, like, where the hell would you go?" The nearest town's 15 miles away, and it's cold. But I stayed there for a year, and you know what was beautiful about it? That's where I met AA. Because it was a program based on AA. So for the first time in my life, there was structure. There were rules. It was simple. And guess who wasn't in control anymore? Me. I gave it up. They laughed about it later and they said, "You know, we spent the first 10 minutes figuring you out. And the next 10 days trying to figure out how to make something out of you." But I went to 2 or 3 meetings a day. There was no TV, there was no television, there was no radio, there was no newspaper, there was no cell phone. Me, my higher power, them, and 17 other people going through the same thing. And 30 days later, and there's no guarantee that they're going to let you go in 30 days. They did. 30 days later when I walked out, I knew I was a different person. Because for the first time in my life, it wasn't about me. It wasn't about ego. For the first time in my life, I didn't think I was any better than anybody else. That's why I'm quiet. That's why I sit in the back. That's why I don't try to take over in these meetings or do anything. I've been there. Run corporations. Don't need to. Need to listen. And that's what you need to do with an open heart and an open mind. And so I don't have the most traditional story in the world. But maybe somewhere in it you can find a little piece of you. And I'd like to leave you with, I've rewritten the Serenity Prayer for me. I have my own Serenity Prayer. It's a little different than maybe the one you're used to. So it's basically, and I will leave you with this thought: God, grant me the serenity to accept the people I cannot change, the courage to change the one I can, and the wisdom to know it's me.